Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, a man whose intelligence we feature with great pleasure on this program. About the war for the free world and its various component parts is one of the most thoughtful men I know. His name is David Goldman. He writes for the Asia Times, usually under the byline Spengler. He is the author of How Civilizations Die and a forthcoming book entitled You Will Be Assimilated. And he is a very valued guest for this program and others as well. David Goldman, it's good to have you back. Welcome. Let me talk to you about an interview that you conducted with my friend and colleague Steve Bannon, who's a member of our Committee on the Present Danger of China, in the Asia Times. And he made an assertion to you, which I think you featured prominently, namely that this election is all about China. What were your thoughts when you heard that, and do you agree?
I think Steve is one of the smartest political analysts I know, and I think it's very likely that his prognostication will turn out to be correct, that President Trump will use the fact that we have a Chinese origin virus that devastated our economy, and China, which is not exactly friendly, well-disposed towards us, as the centerpiece of his campaign, particularly because Chinese Joe Biden was personally handpicked by Obama to conduct the appeasement of the Obama administration towards China, and Obama's son, Hunter, of course, walked away from Chinese sources with a couple of $1 billion worth of investments for his private equity fund, which looks suspiciously like a gigantic bribe to the son of the vice president of the United States. So Biden is very vulnerable on this issue, and I think Trump, as Steve Bannon said, will make this the centerpiece of the campaign, just as he made Hillary Clinton's corruption and illegality the centerpiece of his 2016 campaign. And I hope he wins doing that.
Yeah, me too. Getting a mandate for a robust policy on China seems to me to be of absolutely critical importance here. Let me ask you, one of the things that, of course, is very much in the news at the moment, given yesterday's deep dive by the stock market, is the possibility of another very serious setback, perhaps even a substantial collapse of the stock market between now and the election, something akin perhaps to what happened in 2008. Do you forecast that? And if so, could that happen at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party?
I don't think the Chinese have the capacity to blow up our stock market. I think we are going to see some pullback from the extremely generous valuations we have. As a rough gauge, price of equities relative to forward earnings went up about 24 times, which we haven't seen since 2002. So simply on the valuation base, the stock market was rich. And of course, if we have setbacks in the reopening of the economy, there's already talk in Houston, for example, about a new lockdown in response to a surge in coronavirus cases, then the recovery will be slower than people expect. That's a significant risk. So I think the stock market will be choppy. However, given the massive support that the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government have poured into the economy, it's $6 trillion worth of bailout and support financial markets and income subsidies, I think the likelihood of a stock market crash is extremely small. I mean, a real 2008-style crash.
That's good news indeed. One of the things that has been bruited by some of my colleagues about how to hedge against that is to have the uptick rule restored. David, you know your way around the capital markets. What's the argument for not having in place a mechanism that essentially puts a brake on, you know, panicked or high-frequency trades driving the market into that kind of territory?
I think all the technical mechanisms that you can impose will do is reduce intraday volatilities somewhat. But considering the shocks we've had, you know, we had a 6% move in the market yesterday, 6 or 7%, whether you're looking at the S&P or the Dow, and we had a 12% move one day in March, I think we've realized that we could have massive intraday swings, and it's not going to bring the end of the world about. So I'm much less worried about the technical measures to reduce intraday volatility than I am about the fundamentals.
Yes, well, the fundamentals are critical here, of course. And let me speak to one of them. David, you helped participate in and apparently write up a very interesting program that the American Compass sponsored, specifically focused on the fundamental issue of reshoring back to the States, or at least out of China, critical production and supply lines. Give us a sense of why that is so vital and whether you see in prospect now, given the attention that the administration has been applying to it, and I think a lot of Americans have post-coronavirus, specifically with respect to medicine being produced in China, whether this is going to happen.
President Trump has emphasized bringing American industry back since he began his presidential campaign in 2015. He's absolutely right to emphasize it. We've made a little bit of progress in this, but not nearly enough. The biggest problem we have, in my view, is that Asian countries, not just China, but all of Asia, massively subsidizes capital-intensive industry the way we subsidize football stadiums. And the elites have created a symbiosis, what they call Chimerica, where we do the software and a few people get rich on apps, but the industrial jobs will go to Asia. So it's led to an enormous skew in wealth and economic benefits in favor of the elites who, you know, run the big tech companies, but have gutted the industrial communities of the United States. So bringing industry back means that we're going to have to find a way to subsidize, in either by tax cuts or direct subsidies or other measures, American industry to compete with the Asians. It's not as, you know, I'm a free market guy, but we're dealing with a tilted pool table, and we're going to have to push our side of the table up in order to compensate for what the Asians, particularly the Chinese, are doing. There's no way around that.
And what does that look like? Is that subsidies for returning home, as the Japanese have done? Is it tax incentives and so on when they get back here, all of the above?
Well, the good thing about the American Compass approach is it talks about everything from deregulation to tax changes to R&D subsidies. One obvious example, China is spending per capita three times as much on 5G infrastructure as we are. That's because we look at it as a consumer good to be paid for by the telephone companies. But it's not a consumer good. It's basically an industrial technology. 5G is like the railroad in the 19th century. It makes possible an entire range of new technologies, flexible manufacturing, autonomous vehicles, robotic surgery, telemedicine. It's the basis for a fourth industrial revolution. The Chinese are spending $170 billion on it, massively subsidizing it. We should look at 5G as public infrastructure that the government helps sponsor in order to enable private industry to bring all these new technologies and all of their benefits to bear.
David, we have to leave it at that. This is a subject on which I know you have dwelt in the new book. You will be assimilated, and we're very anxious to talk with you further when it is out. And in the meantime, I thank you for your time today, as well as your expertise on all of these matters. Great to visit with you. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we will speak with George Raceley. We'll touch base with him on the revolution within our streets, among other things, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined by George Raceley. George is a remarkable individual in many respects. He is the editor of Conservative HQ, which is a product of a good friend, Richard Viguerie's organization, and great resource for many of us on matters of policy and politics. He's deeply knowledgeable about both, having spent much of his life in campaigns and in government, including working for then Vice President Dan Quayle on his staff at the White House. He has, to his credit, among other attributes, the status of genius, which we always appreciate, a Mensa pedigreed folk. And we are thrilled to be able to catch up with him, especially at such a moment as this, when there are hugely ominous tectonic shifts taking place in our country, and it's great to have a chance to sort them with him a little bit. George Raisley, welcome back. Good to have you with us, sir. George, you've written a piece at Conservative HQ about the face, I think one might call it, of a police-free zone in Seattle at the moment. I've done a commentary on the subject, but I'd be very interested in your assessment of what this so-called Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone looks like and whether it's pretty much what one would expect if you, in fact, defund the police and remove law enforcement from communities across this country.
Well, it looks a lot like a sort of post-millennial Soviet, if you will, modeled on what the Bolsheviks did in the 1917 Russian Revolution. And they've removed the police only to the extent that the legitimate government's police are gone, but they have their own means of enforcing their new rules through a self-appointed warlord, former rapper Raz Simone, who, along with his crew, are the apparently the only people allowed in the Chaz to have guns, and by virtue of that, they make the rules. To paraphrase Mao Zedong, legitimacy coming from the muzzle of an AK-47.
This obviously does not augur well. I'm told that the thugs that Raz Simone now has policing the zone have begun extorting businesses to pay for their operations, and that what we're seeing is, you know, is increasingly a kind of thuggish intimidation of the people who have the misfortune, I guess, to live in that Chaz area. What are you hearing on that score? And again, when you see signs as you enter this area, you are now leaving the USA. Where does this end, as you see it, George Raisley?
Well, the Seattle police and various local media have reported on the extortion, so I believe it to be true. Where does it end? Well, it really only ends when someone expels them and jails them for their crimes, because they have, at the present time, no reason to leave. They have a series of ever-changing demands that can never be met. So the only alternative really is to restore law and order by expelling them from the area, taking it back for the legitimate authorities, and prosecuting the malefactors who perpetrated this.
At this point, I think it's fair to say that might be a messy bit of business if these folks are armed, as you say, with automatic weapons and the like that could make it a bloody affair. When you look at the people who are bringing this about, apart from this fellow Raz Simone, a rapper, he has associated himself with the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think, like some Americans, George, I've been learning a bit about them in the wake of all of this. And again, this isn't to in any way, diss the people who are authentically protesting racial injustice. But Black Lives Matter as an organization apparently has a very problematic pedigree. According to our friend Trevor Loudon, who was on the show earlier this week, there's a strong strain of Maoism and revolutionary fervor in the Black Lives Matter leadership. Is that what we're confronting here at the end of the day?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we need to differentiate strongly between the people who come out to voice their concerns and their outrage about what happened to Mr. Floyd and what's happened to some other people at the hands of ill-trained police in Democrat-run cities, I might add, and the organizational structure of the organization Black Lives Matter, which is strongly Marxist. Its leadership traces back to communist organizations that have been around for a good long time. And financially, the way it's set up is borders on being a scam. The public record is that very sparse in terms of their legitimacy of their various corporate organization documents. Where the money is going is looking more and more like it's going straight into Democrat campaign coffers and political operations as opposed to helping Black people. And so, you know, we need to very carefully differentiate between the cause of saying that Black Lives Matter and the Black Lives Matter organization, which, as far as my research shows, is, you know, essentially a communist Marxist front organization.
People making those kinds of points are now increasingly being subjected to not only criticism, but censorship. I'm mindful of commentary that Tucker Carlson made earlier this week, in which he didn't quite put it the way you just did, but he certainly raised concerns about what Black Lives Matter, the organization, is doing and the purposes that it's really seeking to advance. He is being punished now by corporate sponsors of his television program on Fox News, who have decided to withdraw from advertising on his show. I'm reasonably sure that there's going to be pressure on him from his network as well. And certainly others, less illustrious than he, are finding this on Twitter and Facebook and Google and so on. Where does that end, George Raceley, if we can't even speak in a factual way? Mind you, I'm not talking about, you know, making rash charges. I'm saying if the record shows that what we're dealing with this organization is its roots, its philosophy, its agenda is, you know, sort of Maoist, communist revolutionary. If we're not allowed to say that without fear of retribution of some kind, what is the end state we're likely to arrive at as a people?
Well, it's gotten to the point where you're not even allowed to ask the question or to, you know, say, hey, what about this? Explain yourself. And of course, if there's a rational explanation or a responsible one, you know, like, oh, hey, we just forgot to send in our $25 corporate registration fee last year versus we let it expire because we don't care about the rules. You know, I don't know where that goes other than an end to all rational, sensible discussion of how civil society should operate. I mean, if we can't even ask a question like that, then our civil society is in serious trouble. And I think we all ought to recognize that part of the reason that this works is because corporate America, in essence, has gone over to the other side. They would much rather give millions of dollars to fake front organization than vet the people who receive their largesse and give it to people who are doing honest work in the inner cities, for example.
Yeah, this is chilling because, as you say, if they're not accounting properly for the funds that they're receiving and they're receiving them in large quantities at the Black Lives Matter organization, there's a potential for a great deal of mayhem to be made. And I think we've seen altogether too much of it already. This is a subject to which we're going to return with Robert Charles in a moment. But let me just say for you, thank you very much, George Raisley, for your time today, as well as your insights into CHAZ and the implications for our country if we do indeed defund the police and not hold accountable those who are engaged in, well, revolutionary activity against our country. Keep up the good work, my friend, at Conservative HQ and in your myriad other media outlets, as well as, of course, come back to us soon at Secure Freedom Radio. Next up, as promised, we will speak with Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State, about the state of the revolution here. That and more, straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm pleased to say we're joined by Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State with responsibility for the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs in the George W. Bush administration. That is the most recent of a number of posts he's held in public office, notably in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses, as well as service in the United States Navy as an intelligence officer, and as well as the practice of law and the teaching of it as well at places like Harvard. Bobby, it's so good to have you with us. A lot to talk about. We were just visiting with George Raisley about what has been going on in the streets of the United States, and he's pretty clear-eyed about the nature of this, well, some call it insurrection. I think of it more as a revolution. What's your attitude?
Well, I think it's very important legally as well as politically and I think socially to understand the difference between peaceful protests and violent riots. And I think it's also important that you dissect this a little further and understand that in the rioting side of this, you have people who are simply out there for their own selfish reasons. And then you also have an organized group. And I have talked with a number of law enforcement officers over the last several weeks, and particularly in the last week. And one of the things that they've pointed out to me is that this is very coordinated. They're finding plats of bricks being placed around ahead of so-called riots or protests. And I think we just have to be very cognizant that there are parties in this country and outside this country that would like nothing more than a coordinated effort at creating chaos. And I think, you know, given the number of cities and given the visuals that we're seeing, which is, you know, a lot of looting, a lot of burning, but also a lot of organized violence, I think we have to be very aware that this is not all peaceful protests.
Well, that's for sure, or even, unfortunately, mostly, when you look at the leadership that is being exhibited by some of these, I think of them as revolutionaries. And that includes, by the way, the Black Lives Matter cadre. It's amazing when you look at their pedigree.
Well, it very sadly, Frank, this goes back to a lot of what people witnessed in the 1960s and actually early 1970s, and frankly wasn't even extinguished until Reagan became president, which is that the Weather Underground and a number of groups very similar to Antifa today had more than nefarious, I mean, more than chaos, more even than anarchy. Their objective was violent revolution. It was their stated objective. Maybe they're being a little less open about what it is now. But the reality is that that the Weather Underground and what I worry about, frankly, is that you see things happening like what's happening in Seattle, and there is a next step to this. And the next step, unfortunately, was bombings in the 1970s. And I am cautious about it, but I'm not, you know, I hope that we don't go that direction. But those who want socialism or violent upheaval don't typically just stop when they get told they need to stop. And what's happening in Seattle is truly, truly something that needs to be addressed.
Let's talk a little bit about that from your perspective as a guy with a considerable background with the law enforcement community. We're hearing, of course, a lot of talk and, in fact, some action, amazingly, on this notion of defunding the police. I've argued in a commentary today that CHAZ, as it's called, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, probably is a pretty good example of what a police-free community looks like. Tell us your thoughts on that and its implications for not just that community, but others as well.
Well, historically, just for context, I have worked with a lot of the nonprofits that are associated with law enforcement, rule of law. And of course, during my time at State, one of my primary jobs was to set up the police training in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And let me just say, the notion of a society without police is utterly absurd. Rule of law, that returns you to John Locke might call, or Hobbes, the state of nature. I mean, meaning everybody is for everybody and nobody is for anybody. And the reality is deterrence is required. That means you have to step in. Look, in this entire country, we have 350 million people. We have only 900,000 law enforcement when you include state, local, and federal. And at a certain point, you simply have to draw a line and have to step in, or you end up with chaos. And I think the average American knows this, Frank. I think most people understand it. The notion that anybody can be talking about defunding the police as if that was some kind of rational alternative, they just simply don't understand how societies work.
Right. I think that's obvious. And Bobby, I failed to mention that one of the things you do these days, in addition to running the Charles Group, is you're the spokesman for the Association of Mature American Citizens and have been very prolific in writing in their publications and speaking on their behalf. And I'm sure the vast majority of those several million people are, like, as you say, most Americans wanting no part of an experiment in the law of the jungle. The idea that this was something that we would inflict upon our elderly or our children, or for that matter, any of us, is simply abominable. And I can't believe how far this has progressed under those circumstances.
You're absolutely right. And I think stepping in is the responsibility of local police, state police, and federal police, and then if necessary, National Guard, and frankly, an Insurrection Act would warrant stepping in with active duty, even though that's the last resort. Let me just say about the AMAC generation, that particular group, AMAC.us, which people can go to and join, is 26% veterans, and actually almost 75% of that 2 million plus group of Americans who I think are very concerned about the future of the country, which is why that group, one of the big reasons it exists, it pushed a lot of legislation, not just in this area, but for veterans and other areas tied to the future of the country. One of the reasons they're so deeply concerned is that 75% of that group have some family member who's a veteran. And I just want to come back to the fact that when people serve, and I served, but you know, not the way many of these veterans served, when people are overseas, and whether it was World War II or Korea or Vietnam or the Persian Gulf War One or Two, they come back here, they're fighting for something. They're fighting for the law and order and peace and contentment and society that we have here. We are exceptional. And if we let that exceptionalism go, we pay a terrible price and we also dishonor their service.
Let me ask you about drawing on your experience with the State Department as well as your service in the Navy. This isn't happening in a vacuum. All of this mayhem is coming not only in the midst of a presidential election season, though it's kind of hard to get your head around that given the distractions of the pandemic and lockdown and so on. But it is that, you know, we're several months away from one of the most, if not arguably the most important election of our time. And there are lots of hostile powers who we know would like to have a say in the outcome of that election, who we know are determined to defeat Donald Trump, and we know are capable of exploiting this chaos. They may, I personally believe, in the case of China, they are actually implicated in precipitating it, but at the very minimum, they are taking full advantage of it. Tell us about your perspective on the extent to which this dimension of the problem adds further urgency to getting our hands around it and bringing it to an end.
Yeah, you are right on, Frank. We do not live in a society that is isolated in any way, shape, or form. We have both state and non-state actors that would love nothing better to see us implode. The degree to which we do not order our own society helps them in all kinds of ways, both obvious and not so obvious. Democracies are always subject, because we're an open society, we are always subject to the intrusion of foreign and non-state destabilizing factors. And you're absolutely right. Of all the countries that are out there that would wish us harm, I think China and Iran may be the two that would wish us the most harm and have the greatest capacity to potentially inflict it in terms of disturbing our society. China has cyber capabilities. They have all kinds of additional tools for disrupting us. I think part of what average Americans have to do is just remember that we are always on guard. We should be on guard for the preservation of the rule of law here for its own sake. But we also need to be on guard against adversaries, state and non-state, who would want to do us harm from abroad. And there are a lot of I'll call them organized groups that are not state actors that would also like to do us harm. And, you know, all you have to do is go back in history and understand that whenever we have been disrupted internally, our foreign adversaries have taken advantage. And we just cannot let that happen.
Let me just ask you specifically, again, knowing what you do about the ambitions of Xi Jinping's regime in China, to just speculate on what might yet be in store for us. They've unleashed a pandemic upon us. As I say, I think they've contributed to, at least if you look at their cadre in this country, and most people are unaware there is such a thing, but there are dozens of Maoist groups, and many of them are at the forefront of these riots and insurrectional activities. I was talking with David Goldman earlier about the possibility that the Chinese might use techniques that they certainly are familiar with to prompt a major sell-off in our stock markets, something we saw a bit of yesterday, of course, but much worse could be forthcoming. Do you anticipate that they will pull out all of the stops in order to ensure Donald Trump is defeated and that the possible extent of the interference in our elections will make whatever was alleged about Russian interference in the last one pale by comparison?
Well, let me say that China is out for China, and this is in some ways a perfect storm. We have a weakened economy, one that is still struggling to recover, and it is the result of this coronavirus having hit and our lockdown decisions at the state level, but obviously recommended by medical experts. If you look then at this instability and beginnings of insurrection type behavior in the United States, again, creates an opportunity for China. And it's a dual opportunity. It's an opportunity to disrupt our election cycle, but it's also an opportunity to act as an aggressor abroad. And I think China has both of those objectives in mind.
We have to leave it at that. Bobby Charles, thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for the work you do at AMAC. Check it out at amac.us. You can find his extensive writings there, and I know we'll benefit from them, as do I. We appreciate your time today, sir. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Tara Oh about the challenge we're now facing from South Korea, a putative ally, perhaps no more. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our guest, Dr. Tara Oh, who has been very much engaged for years in the issues that affect our security interests in Northeast Asia. She has served in the United States Air Force, rising to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel, pulling three tours in South Korea. She also served in the Pentagon, working on Asia-Pacific issues, as well as in European Command in NATO, and has gone on to found a terrific organization, the East Asia Research Center. And she is one of our go-to sources on what's going on with South Korea. And we talk about it with others from time to time, notably with our friend Gordon Chang, who recently wrote a book called Losing South Korea. And I think, Tara, much of your work bears out just how far gone the country has moved, basically, under the regime of the present president of South Korea, Moon Jae-in. It's good to have you with us. Thank you for taking some time to talk through this with us. So give us a sense, if you could, of the state of U.S. South Korean relations at the moment. The character of the Moon regime, and specifically, Tara, the extent to which it's really seemingly realigning this long-time, very important ally of the United States with two of its most serious adversaries, Communist China and North Korea.
Yes, you're right. I want to begin by saying that there is a difference in between the leadership in South Korea, so President Moon Jae-in and the National Assembly, which is dominated by his party, and the will of the people. They're two separate, because the will of the people, most of the people support U.S.-South Korea alliance, and they want their country to remain liberal democracy and market economy. But that is not where the Moon Jae-in administration is taking South Korea right now, because Moon and the people who surround him, they harbor socialist ideas. They always talk about equality, but again, they're not talking about equality before the law, which would be fine. It's one of the liberal democracy concepts, rule of law. He's talking about an equal outcome, which is basically socialist communist outcome. Ever since he became president in May 2017, he has showed pro-North Korea and pro-China tendencies. And he has said that he wants to achieve what's called low-level federation with North Korea. And basically what that means is achieving a unified Korea under North Korea's rule, because that is actually the goal of North Korea. North Korea has said that since Kim Il-sung days. So let me just point out some of the activities that occurred in South Korea that, you know, point to that. Let me start with the market economy. So we know that it's South Korea's very vibrant market economy. It is world, sometimes 11th largest, sometimes world's 12th largest economy in the world, very active in international trade. So it is slowly trying to turn South Korean businesses into, they either try to nationalize them or try to take over the management so that the government makes decisions. And that is hallmark of socialism. So with the Samsung, it's world's sixth largest. I mean, we all have Samsung phones, TVs. We're very familiar with it. They've been investigated for the past 4 years. And then in the last year and a half, it's been especially concentrated over 50 search and seizure activities. And the Samsung chairman, he was even taken to jail for a year while the trial was going on. His trial is still going on. So he should not be held in jail. I mean, most people, you put people in jail if they are going to tamper with evidence or, you know, something like that. But there was no cases with him, but they did that. They're forcing Samsung to unionize. They're forcing Samsung to have union leadership in the management. This is forcing them to do a lot of things that a normal company wouldn't do.
Including, as I understand it, Tara, they're building the facilities for making chips without U.S. technology, which would essentially enable the Chinese to get around the current restrictions on the use of such American technology. If this, in fact, winds up helping, among others, the Chinese military pose a more severe threat to, well, both South Korea and the United States and Japan and others, this is obviously a very unfriendly thing for them to be doing. And if, as you say, this is really being done at the behest of the Moon government, it's further evidence of their proclivities.
Yes. In addition to that, it's also trying to destroy various pillars of liberal democracy. So, for example, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, the separation of power, checks and balances, things like that. It's eroded at every level. So, for example, let me tell you about this former prosecutor of 28 years. He had a lot of spy cases. And he, Mr. Ko Young-joo, he called President Moon Jae-in a communist. And he thought that it was his duty to warn people. He said it's a matter of time for South Korea to become communist if he becomes president. He said this back in 2013 when Moon Jae-in was running for president back then as well. And He said that because Moon Jae-in used to, you know, he's known as a human rights lawyer, but actually what he did was he defended all the spy cases or agent cases, people that are doing either socialist communist activities or pro-North Korea activities. And so now Moon Jae-in is trying to silence him, and he's suing him in the civil court, as well as criminal court. So, the prosecutors are trying to put him in jail for a year and a half because he said Moon Jae-in is a communist.
Years ago. And so this is, again, just evidence of kind of the tendencies of Moon Jae-in. But just to put a fine point on it, if I could, Dr. Tara Oh, the United States clearly is now facing in Moon Jae-in an unreliable partner, it would seem to me. The, you know, effort to denuclearize the North Korean regime and the Korean Peninsula kind of hangs in the balance. But more generally, so does the defensive perimeter that we've had in South Korea. Is it fair to say that if Moon has his way, in the not too distant future, there's a distinct possibility that U.S. forces will be told to withdraw, and that we could see this incremental unification of the peninsula? Again, it's just unimaginable, but on more or less North Korea and China's terms.
Yes, U.S. withdrawal. Now, I don't think that even Moon Jae-in, although that's what he wants, I don't think he can make that happen because people will notice. People will notice, and he does not want people to notice and be surprised. So I think that's such a drastic move, although that is one of his goals, and that is one of North Korea's goals. Wanting to achieve North Korea or Korean Peninsula that's dominated by North Korea, they want U.S. withdrawal, which is why we shouldn't do it, because it is what they want to do. And if that happens, then we will lose China. I mean, we will lose South Korea to China. So, we can't let that happen. But that is what he wants to do. And I think we need to we need to call him out. When he does these kind of things, we need to call him out. For example, he's trying to get around the sanctions. He's constantly trying to get around the sanctions, and they're actually trying to pass laws right now. And I think we need to be more strict about implementing sanctions and even holding South Korean leaders and different individuals accountable.
Well, this is a tall order, and I think you're absolutely right. Much needed, because in the absence of it being out in the daylight, if you will, the Klieg lights being on, much of this is being done sort of surreptitiously and incrementally and inexorably. And what I'm heartened by, and I'm sure my audience is as well, is the sentiment that you suggest is widespread among the South Korean people. But what is very worrying is that it seems that notwithstanding their sentiment, the attitude and policies of Moon Jae-in are very much in a different direction. This is the rub. And so we appreciate your coming aboard with us today, Tara Oh, and the work you do at the East Asia Research Center to really call attention to these developments and hopefully help us stave them off before some very ominous strategic transitions are made that will be problematic for freedom-loving people in South Korea as well as here. Thank you for your time today. Come back to us soon if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.